everyone. I'd like to call to order the April 16, 2013 session of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. We're in session. Good morning to everyone. We're going to start off this morning with a, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2841 and welcome Representative Bentz to our committee. Before he starts, Beth, could you tell us a little bit about that bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2841 would, there is a, both a dash one and a dash two amendment in front of you. The dash two was just received, so I cannot speak to that. I believe Representative Bentz will. But this bill addresses recreational placer mining and required consultations between the agencies and potentially affected parties when rules are being adopted or orders are being issued.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Representative Bentz.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Cliff Bentz, District 60, appearing in support of House Bill 2841, in particular Dash 2 amendments. And before I scare anyone further about this being OSU Day, it's not.
It's too much.
I'm a day ahead. A lot of people looking frantically for their orange
ties.
No, that's a wait until tomorrow. So this is just a crass attempt to influence Representative Clem's vote.
This is a warm-up.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for hearing House Bill 2841. The idea here is to assist small-scale mining and, of course, recreational mining, but small-scale mining is extremely important to my district. And this bill is an attempt to get the miners out of the courtroom and into their minds. The idea is to have folks talk about it before it reaches the point of litigation, and this bill does just that. We've modified it slightly in the Dash 2 amendments to qualify a bit, define a bit the word consult, and then secondly to talk a little bit more about the type of scientific studies. At one time it said all scientific studies. It now says they'll simply consider reasonably available and relevant studies. Members of the committee, I won't take much more of your time other than to say this is an extremely important bill to my district. It will help get people again out of the courtroom and into the areas where they're making money for our state and helping our economy. So I would encourage, of course, and I vote on these when the time comes, and I appreciate you taking the time to hear the bill, and most importantly, to hear the folks who have driven so far to testify later today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And Representative Bentz, before we take questions or comments, I just want to ask you, we're also likely to be working House Bill 2032 this morning. And is that anything that you'd like to comment on? Because if it is, I can open a temporary work session on that.
Maybe if you would, Mr. Chair, that is our wetlands bill, is it not?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
Yes, maybe I would like to just say one thing, if you would be so kind.
All right. I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 2841 and temporarily open a work session on House Bill 2032.
And, Mr. Chair, again, for the record, State Representative Fence District 60, I just want to say we support the, I believe it's the Dash 4 amendments?
Dash 8
amendments. And after much work and focus, we think we finally have it right, and we appreciate the committee's support of that that bill as amended. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments of Representative Bentz on 2032 before I close that work session temporarily? Yes, Representative Clem, please.
Why don't you like my dash 9 through 84?
I haven't had much time to review those yet, Representative Clem. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're working on it, Representative Clem.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Representative Reardon.
Actually, I'm sorry, I have to correct you. Actually, every day is Beaver Day.
Oh, yeah. Of course it is.
Oh, wow.
Thank you for that correction.
wait till the green comes out.
Exactly.
Seeing nothing more, I'm going to temporarily close the work session on House Bill 2032, reopen a public hearing on House Bill 2841, and are there questions or comments for the good representative on the recreational mining bill? I'm not seeing any. Thank you very much, Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Have a wonderful day. With that, I'd like to call up, please, Guy Michael. Tom, it looks like Kitcher. And Greg Aldrich, please. Mr. Aldrich, if you'd like.
Good morning to each of you.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Chair Witt and committee members. I'm Greg Aldrich. I'm from the Department of Environmental Quality and the Water Quality Administrator. I'm here to talk about the DEQ process for the renewal of the NPDS, or National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, permit. It's a general permit for suction dredging, known as the 700 PM. The current permit that's in effect was issued in 2010 and will expire on December 31st of 2014, so more than a year from now. Currently, we are working on that next permit so that we will have one in place by the end of next year, and that is our goal, to do that and not have an expired permit, which would essentially shut down all the suction dredge mining. What we are trying to do is develop a very good permit, have a good public process, and consider the multitude of needs out there, including the miners, homeowners who are concerned primarily about noise, the river outfitters and guides who are other river users, and obviously the conservation and environmental community. We must balance the concerns of all these people. I think today one of the biggest issues I've been hearing about is, what is the public process and how do we gauge in that? I think two things to start off with. One is the advisory committee process. And DEQ, as a state agency, uses two approaches. One is very clearly outlined in the Administrative Procedures Act, and that is the formal request that I think you're seeing in the Dash 2 amendment and in the bill itself. And that is to have a formal stakeholder group of appointed members that we work with through the process of developing, in this case, it's a department order known as the general permit. The other process that's out there for working with stakeholder groups is a stakeholder forum. And the reason there's two different processes is, one, the one that's very formalized with a stakeholder advisory group works very well when you work with formalized groups like business agencies, environmental groups and like that, who are very used to working in that manner. If you are developing a rule or a permit that actually involves a lot of individuals, and suction dredge miners, an example of that, we have found that stakeholder forums may be a better way to reach out to them. Instead of having 10 to 20 people around a table discussing with DEQ versions of the rule, you're able to have big meetings inviting all interested parties to come together. We share information, we take in information, we process it, we come back to another meeting and go through that several times. So we think it's a way to engage more people. But again, obviously, if the preference of this body is to actually do the former one, where we have a smaller set group, we will do that. We would probably still look at somehow of making sure we engage the larger community, because we think that is really important when there are so many individuals involved. Obviously, combining the two processes will cost us slightly more, but I think what's more important is that we have a good process, and I totally agree with Representative Benz. We would love to stay out of the legal arena on this. As for the actual process for engaging individuals, we are very committed to a public process and a robust one. It is true that we have statutes and rules that require it, but we aren't just trying to meet the requirements. We want a process that works for the miners and other interested parties. And we know that one of the challenges is that we're not dealing with a group of folks who are just used to working through an association like the Oregon Association of Industries or a League of Cities or something like that. But many times some are affiliated with different mining groups and many others are just individuals. And we want to reach out and hear from them and engage them and hopefully address their needs. For the permit that's currently in place that was implemented back in the middle of 2010, we had an extensive process. We had public meetings around the state. And as our attempt to this time have even a more extensive one, we had our first big public meeting. Many of you are aware of it. back in March down in Medford. I believe over 100-plus people showed up. It was well-noticed and well-attended. And again, our intent was to pull in the traditional folks, the organized folks, as well as all the individuals who would be interested. We are currently reviewing the information that we received from that meeting, lots of input. We plan to meet again with those folks in various forums, and at least twice in the second half of this year. And through those second set of meetings, we will draft a permit early in 2014. We will then start an official public process with the draft permit out there for review. Right now, that's tentatively scheduled for March 21st of 2014. So you can see we put some real thought in this with real dates. Our intent is to hold three public hearings in late April of next year, close for public comment on April 28th, so that means there's more than 40 days there for public process. Our requirement is 30 days. And, of course, people can always ask for more if they so choose to. In May of June of next year, we would review the comments, look at those comments, respond to them, modify the permit if needed, and then our goal is to issue it in June, on June 30th of next year. That gives 6 months for a permit to be in place before it becomes effective at the end of December of next year. One is we want to really make sure that permit is out there, because again, if we don't have a permit and the current one expires and not replaced, it shuts down the system, and we don't want to do that. And two, it allows people 6 months to become familiar with whatever changes will occur between the existing permit and a future permit. So again, I want to emphasize we really do want to work with the mining community as well as the others who have very great interest in what we put in for this permit. A couple other things, and relates very specifically to the draft two amendments that just came out. Again, if the will is to have a formal advisory committee as opposed to these ad hoc, pull in all the stakeholders who are interested, we will do that. We're a little bit concerned about the language of consulting, because consulting without definition, and this is on line 13 of the dash 2, can be very open-ended, particularly for a judge. And, of course, we want to hear from the people on all sides and try to address the needs as best as we can, balancing many different issues. We plan to have a public comment period. Right now, it's there for 40 days. We plan to consult with individual groups, so like mining groups, miners groups who would be interested in meeting us during the public comment period. That's what we did in 2010. We would certainly do it again. And if to meet the requirements as stressed, set out here, if we need to meet with them even before the public comment period opens, we would be glad to do that. We acknowledge and really appreciate Representative Bence's office willing to change line 18 to reasonably available and relevant scientific studies. It's very easy to find a study that we missed, and this makes it very clear. We're looking at everything we can find, but there may be things out there that we will miss. Again, going on to page 2 of the amendments, I'm a little unclear how to best look at lines 2 through 5. In our rulemaking process and in our permit development process, when something goes out for public comment, we open it up for, in this case, almost 40 days to take formal comment and to meet with groups during that comment period. People get the opportunity to submit written comments or provide oral comments at one of the three public hearings that we're proposing to have. Traditionally, in the way we're the State Administrative Procedures Act allows two ways for agencies to deal with the public comment process. Ours is once the public comment process ends, we then stop meeting with any groups. We just go ahead, take the comments, respond to them, finalize the permit, and issue the permit. Or if it's in rulemaking, we would put together the staff report for our Environmental Commission and take it to them. But all discourse with the public and special interest groups and like that would end at the close of public comment period.
Mr. Aldrich?
Yeah.
Appreciate the explanation of the process.
Yeah.
Could you, if there are substantive comments remaining, if you could summarize those?
Yep. So
please.
I think what, for us, the challenge is, what do you mean on page 2, given that lines 2 through 6, because we definitely want to consult, but I think what we would like to acknowledge is our role, how we're implementing the APA, Procedures Act, and that really consultation won't occur after that point in time. Be glad to meet with them up until the time it's issued. So I just want to state that. I think otherwise, other than what I've acknowledged, particularly the consultation part, which can be very open-ended, particularly from a judge's point of view, we appreciate the revised language and working with Representative's office on that. I just want to close by saying I think we have a very extensive public process. I hope the minors agree as well as the other people out there. Obviously, we could always do more, but we are limiting, you know, trying to balance multiple things at the same time. Sorry if I went on too long.
Thank you very, very much, and appreciate not only your testimony, but your willingness to make yourself and the department available to talk with the minors.
Sure.
Thank you for that. Gentlemen, good morning.
Morning.
Good morning. Chairman Witt, committee, my name is Tom Kitcher. I'm president of the Waldo Mining District. We were established April 1st, 1852 in southwestern Oregon, probably the first government body in southern Oregon. I handed out, I think all of you should have gotten a copy, I have a cover letter here of a few documents to try to explain why we need this change in the statute 517.125. When the 2010 permit was being drafted, several mining organizations, including the Waldo Mining District, formally requested to DEQ for consultation on this permit. We were denied that. DEQ informed us that because the new permit was going to be issued as an order instead of a rule, there was no need for them to consult with us. They did hold a town hall meeting where DEQ did not answer any questions at all. We had one more meeting with them in Salem. It was pretty much an all-day meeting, packed in a little room. And again, DEQ did not answer any questions, did not bargain, deliberate. They just let us talk, wrote down our comments. When we asked them questions, we'll have to get back to you on that. Well, they did when they issued the permit. The first document that I gave you is called Issues and Concerns Regarding the Proposed 700 PM Permit Final Draft. I'm not going to read this thing. If you folks want to, I'm submitting this to help show you some of the concerns we had with the permit that were never addressed in any form of consultation. We never received any answers from DEQ until the permit came out. The second document is actually from Representative Gordon Anderson, retired, dealing with what happened with the 2005 permit and then the 2010 permit. And I just want to draw your attention to the bottom of page 1 in bold, where it says, this is Gordon Anderson writing, and I'm sorry to say, it is my understanding that the department to date has not met with in consultation with any of the affected parties pertaining to the new permit as required by ORS 517-125. If you go to page 2, just about in the middle, in bold again, I find it extremely disappointing that an agency of the state of Oregon is now apparently fully prepared to go back on its word and renege on a duly bargained compromise adopted in full consultation with the affected parties and originally proposed by the current permit, Gordon made a typo there, of the permit, especially in light of the fact that the department seemingly has no new data or evidence to support any change in the conditions. And then at the very bottom, I find it deeply disturbing that the agency of the state of Oregon is prepared to restrict the statutory rights of miners under the U.S. mining laws without any new data or information simply because there might be a challenge to the permit. These permits since 2005 have been challenged in courts by the miners and the environmental movement. We are still in court. The most recent case, in the middle of, we were all combined together in Marion County. The court declared all three parties to be parties of each other's cases. We challenged the Northwest Environmental Defense Center's standing to challenge an order, because they are not we do not believe they are harmed or aggrieved. They, in about a year, they dribbled us information, and before they were due to send us the last bit of information on discovery to prove they had standing, we learned that they had met secretly with DEQ, made a secret settlement agreement. DEQ or NEDC agreed to drop their suit, and DEQ paid them $7,500 of taxpayers' money and agreed to a whole, basically we call it a laundry list of restrictions and prohibitions that NEDC would like DEQ to consider in the next permit, and granted them what we believe is special stakeholder standing, even that above the affected parties. We're basically being trampled to death. The last document, actually I kind of went out of order, is just a little bit of testimony by the DEQ permit writer under oath during depositions for the upcoming litigation. Before the decision came out in the 2005 litigation, which came out in December of 2009, in June of 2009, the U.S. Supreme Court had ruled on a case over, our problem is DEQ is sticking us with a EPA 402 permit.
Tom,
I'm sorry.
Too complicated. Excuse me.
Sure.
I would prefer that you not get too far down into the weeds in terms
sure.
of any pending court cases. First of all, I personally, I can't speak for my other committee members, I'm going to be reluctant to get involved in an existing court case. Secondly, without the benefit of the case background, it's difficult for us to even be able to get our arms around it. So if you could keep it at the 30,000 foot level, it would be appreciated.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry. I'll make it real simple. Had we been allowed to consult with DEQ, they would have been more aware of this case and possibly would have changed their mind. Also, we had submitted a study. They had it. They knew they had it, and they didn't look at it because they decided it was too old, and that also might have altered what came out in the permit. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Guy, good morning.
Good morning, Representative Chair. There's a lot here. There's so much information. Getting it down into small bullets is very difficult. I really appreciate distinguished DEQ for, I didn't hear anything in his testimony that I could disagree with, practically. So I just wanted to say...
Mr. Michael, would you, just for the public record, would you please introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Guy Michael, and I'm from Baker City.
Welcome.
Oregon. Thank you. Let's see. Where do I need to start? Well, there needs to be a correction, I guess, what we could do in the Senate if we get this bill passed. The main purpose is to, because DEQ has stated that when the 2010 permit was going, that they're issuing this permit as an order, which the legislature has made available in 468B.0502 to issue orders, permits as orders. So the problem, there's been some consultation prior under rules, but now they didn't have to, but they said they would a little bit. And we needed to update the statute so that orders are included. One of the corrections will have to be later, but we accept House Bill 2841-2 would be that remove, where is it, the advisory committees for orders. Currently in the APA statute, advisory committees aren't required for orders. It's just for rules. And the purpose of this bill, House bill, is we didn't want to change anything that is current. It's just to basically add orders to the consultation process. Okay, now I'm going to switch gears a little bit. You have my previous testimony or comments,
yes.
April 4th, and I've pretty much got everything there. What I wanted to concentrate on in what little time I have is the mining rights and why it's so important for consultation. And what I want to express was is that we're not here just because we have a privilege. And I'm not going to go into all the laws that describe it, but if you're a recreationalist, you have a privilege. And it's by acquiescence of Congress, Curtis, USA versus Curtis, describes that really well. It was an excellent court case. But I wanted to describe just a couple little things that show why we have property and what the mining law grants. And it grants a right to exploration, occupation, and property in minerals with the surface of the federal land that is open to mineral entry. Now, the term occupation doesn't mean you can occupy. It means that as well, but it means a job. In other words, you actually are granted the right to work the surface and the minerals of the federal land. That's part of the requirement. The California Coastal Commission versus Granite Rock decision in the Supreme Court stated that the state could reasonably require regulation for environmental concerns. So that's great. There's a lot of miners that are on one side of the scale that say, no, that state can't. But we're not here for that. We're here to say that the state does have jurisdiction for reasonable environmental concerns. Although that Supreme Court in Granite Rock didn't discuss what those concerns were.
Because we have such a long agenda today, if you have a number of items of rights that may have been granted previously, could you just tick those off for us quickly, please, sir?
Okay.
Thank you.
Let's see. How do I do that? This is not easy. My brain is somewhere else right at the
moment. I apologize, sir.
Okay. The one thing that, rather, I don't need to go into all the rights. I've explained the part of the rights that I wanted to share, but I also wanted to say that the Granite Rock decision also stated that the state land use regulation could not conflict with the federal scheme. So we're saying that the federal scheme allows us to be there, we have jurisdiction to be there, and we're saying that the state has a right to be there. But and those jurisdictions can intermingle. The problem is we need consultation because And this is the difference between the consultation that is current and what we're asking for. The difference is we need a time before it ends where we can sit down and have a face-to-face discussion. And that's really all we really need, because we have a chance. Because they cannot prohibit us, and we don't want to prohibit them. But we need a face-to-face discussion as part of that consultation. That's really the key, that the difference between public comment receive comment, and then they give back a response, but there is no discussion in between. So if we can do this in the beginning, before they get that process, the bill asks for 30 days ahead of time, then I think we have a chance to work out, resolve some differences based on our rights, and perhaps limit the actual court case costs later. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much. You'll excuse my pun, but I can't help myself. It's the consultation that's the nugget of your testimony here. So.
If I may, I do have a definition that...
sorry, Representative Krieger.
If I may.
Please. I'm sorry.
I do have a definition that could be adjusted, if you will. For the purpose of this section, consultation means a meeting and discussion of changes in rules and orders with a response of agreement or disagreement to the affected parties.
Thank you very, very much, sir. I appreciate all of your testimonies. Committee members, do we have any questions or comments for this panel? Representative Krieger, please.
The DEQ, the permit you say is going to expire is a state-issued permit?
Correct. Representative Krieger,
correct. What would an amendment to this bill stating that the existing permit shall be in force until you get your work done.
On the new permit.
We can put it in here that the existing permit is valid until you replace it with one. There wouldn't be a gap between the two.
Oh, correct. Chair, Representative Creer, correct, yes. But our intent is we often have general permits that expire and that prohibits us from assigning coverage or allowing someone to do something under an expired permit. Our attempt here is to make sure that does not expire, so in fact there is continual coverage.
Well, what I'm saying is, in regards to what your rules are, those are administrative rules. State statute could say that your existing permit is valid for these people to do their work, so there wouldn't be a gap between you getting your work done and issuing the new permit. Do you object to that?
I do not. The only thing, because it's a federal permit, I'm not sure if there would be a problem from a federal perspective, but I can certainly check into that and get back to you.
Okay. And the other members? Representative Reardon, could we just summarize the sequence of different conversations that would go along in the permitting process? Does this new action precede the permitting process, or is it in the middle of, or?
Mr. Aldrich, is that something that?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
I'm not sure. We have an amendment here that describes a new layer of process or new conversation. When does that take place relative to the permitting process? I'm just, maybe I wasn't listening closely enough.
Chair Witt and Representative Brugin, as I interpret it, it would mean it would go into effect basically immediately for the renewal process. So the process we just started earlier this year for the permit that would be issued by the end of next year. So it's early enough to actually implement, you know, incorporate this into the process that's already been spelled out for this permit.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Mike?
No, he answered.
Okay.
That was
very good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Could I add one other thing?
Please.
Chair, the new definition that was just offered might be a very workable definition.
Well, thank you.
So I just want to offer that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. We're coming closer already.
Yes, we
this
are.
Is great progress.
Great progress.
Anyone else from the committee? Seeing none, gentlemen, thank you very, very much. I appreciate everyone working on this and trying to find the common ground, and we're going to continue. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to call up, please, Tom Quintal.
Tom, welcome back to our committee.
You're a frequent flyer this time.
Yeah, I'm getting to be. Chairman Witt and members of the committee, my name is Tom Quintal, and you were talking about the 30,000-foot level. Well, I go way back on this thing. In fact, the information that you should have shortly would be on the Senate Bill 1152. That goes back to the 70th legislative session in 1999. Okay? You'll notice that there should be a highlighted section in Section 3 where it says, any rule pertaining to recreational small-scale mining adopted after the effective date of 1999 Act shall be adopted in consultation with affected parties. Okay, that's one of our issues that we've had since 1999. Now, I really hope the this committee can support 2841-1. ORS 517-125 was put in law with Senate Bill 1152 during that legislative session. And what's going on now, we have DEQ issuing orders to circumvent basically the rule issue. And one of the main problems that I have seen over the years trying to deal with DEQ is the fact that they tend to go ahead and give you what they call a draft for a permit. Well, that to them is consultation. Unfortunately, we never get a chance to sit down with them prior to their draft and go over some of these very excessive restrictions. For example, we currently are using, according to what they say is necessary, the 700 NPDS permit. I don't know.
Tom, if, may I please interrupt?
Okay.
If your testimony is going to take a couple
of
minutes.
It's not. It's going to be real quick.
Okay, thank you. We have someone waiting in the wings.
Oh, sure. What I wanted to call your attention to is on page 8 and 9. The penalties on this permit is for an industrial permit. Some of the fines in here go up to $100,000. Some of them are $25,000 a day. Some of them are 6 years in jail or both. So bottom line on this thing, we really need to put some teeth into the consultation statute so that we get a fair chance to sit down with these folks before they even bring the draft out. And that's what we call consultation. So it's an exchange of ideas and suggestions, and hopefully then we can all live with the final result instead of ending up in court. So that's all my testimony, and if you have any questions, I sure would be happy to answer them.
Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate your testimony as always. Committee members, do we have anything this morning for Tom?
Mm-hmm.
Not seeing anything.
Okay,
thank you very, very much, sir. Just a show of hands, if there is anyone else who would be interested this morning in testifying on House Bill 2841. If there isn't anyone, I'm going to just close the hearing for the day. That I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2841, and I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3408, and recognize our colleague, Representative Kenny Geyer. Welcome to our committee. Good morning.
Thank you. Hello, committee. For the record, I'm Alyssa Kenny Geyer. I represent House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. I know you have a really full agenda today. I just want to say that I'm very honored to be here in partnership with the Oregon Humane Society around a bill that is looking out for the protection of animals. This bill allows the agencies that remove the animal to have more say in where the animal gets placed after there's been abuse. This does not mean that the animal cannot necessarily be returned to the extended family from which it came. In some cases, that may be appropriate. In many cases, it may not be appropriate. I will let them fill in on the details, but it doesn't take away that possibility, but it just means that really you're putting the judgment with the agency that determines what's the best interest for the animal that's been abused. So unless there are any questions, I'll let you call up the people who have brought this bill to my attention.
Well, and we a little unorthodox here, but I recognize that you may have something that you want to add to the dash about the dash 3 amendments on House Bill 3364.
I would love to just say a word about that.
Okay, if you'll hold on just for a second, I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 3408 and temporarily open a work session on House Bill 3364, the Integrated Pest Management. And Beth, would you... We've got so much paperwork up here, we're drowning.
I know.
If you could remind us just briefly about this bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3364 was heard on April 4th. It's the bill that directs the state agencies and university system participants on integrated pest management to coordinate with IPM coordinator at Oregon State University. There is a dash 3 amendment which replaces the measure.
And I suspect that, Representative, you'll be pleased to know that we've removed the subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means. So.
Yes. So I just wanted to put a quick word in for this. There were 11 versions of this bill before we ever even got to the dash one. So Gabriella Goldfarb from the governor's office, along with all of the state agencies involved, and Paul Jepson, who's the IPM coordinator at OSU, Lisa DeBerger, who's Invasive Species Council, Beyond Toxics, who was the nonprofit organization that represented many other organizations, community groups, nonprofits, and public citizens, and Oregonians for Food and Shelter that represents the growers and some of the pesticide applicators, pesticide companies. Everyone came together on this bill, contributed every single version of those 11 different versions before it became Dash 1. The Dash 1 came to you just, it was released a couple days before it came to you, and so then we did some very small technical tweaks on it for the Dash 2 and the Dash 3, which is what you see here. So they're very small technical fixes. I think because the agencies see this not as a burden, but as something that improves their ability to do IPM. They already have IPM programs, and by partnering with Paul Jepson, it really allows them to do, you know, tap into the evidence-based best practices, coordinate their efforts. Because of that, they have not put any significant fiscal on this, and OSU is contributing a significant amount of money to support Paul Jepson's work. There is a small fiscal on it, but under the Ways and Means cap. So really, I'm here to say that these are very small technical fixes. We have agreement from everyone. We've had fantastic cooperation and a tremendous amount of work from everyone on all of those 11 versions, and the Dash 1, Dash 2, and now Dash 3.
Very good. Thank you. Are there any questions or comments for our good colleague? I'm not seeing any. Thank you very much.
Okay.
And with that, I'm going to close temporarily the work session on House Bill 3364. Stand at ease momentarily. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2615. Beth, if you'd tell us about that one, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2615 is being replaced entirely by the Dash 2 amendment. The Dash 2 would revise the statutes governing the harvest of special forest products. It replaces the term mushroom with fungi to include truffles as a special forest product. In effect of July 1st, 2014, would make the definition of special forest products in statute more general and then stipulate that the identification of those products would be by administrative rule by the State Board of Forestry.
Thank you very much. Okay. I'd like to call up, please, Roger Beyer. You may bring whoever you'd like. Welcome to all.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. I'm just going to very briefly describe what the substantive changes in this, what looks like a very complicated bill, so hopefully try to break it down for you a little bit. Beth did a great job. Basically, on page 2 of the bill, the Dash 2 amendments on lines 7 through 10 are really the only substantive changes in this part of the bill. Under current law, a truffle is not a mushroom, and the current law says wild edible mushrooms
are a special forest product. We've had situations where our members have had truffles stolen and have not been able to prosecute because they are not mushrooms. So we are changing that definition to wild edible fungi rather than wild edible mushroom. The next lines, so lines J, you see, we're allowing the Board of Forestry to identify by rule some other items in this, what a special forest products are. If you then go to the page 7 of the amendments, lines 7 through 13 is the section where starting July 1st, 2014, we will eliminate that list of what special forest products are. We're replacing it with a generic list of plant parts, fungi parts, fruit, rocks, minerals that are identified by the State Board of Forestry, firewood, and trees or parts of trees of a species identified in board rules as a forest tree species, not normally used in commercial forest harvests. What we're trying to get at there is potential of people like maybe stealing a maple burl off the side of a tree. A maple tree is a commercial forest product, but a maple burl would not be, so that would be the maple burl would be a special forest product, but the tree itself is not. It's a commercial forest product. And finally, Mr. Chair, if you go to the back page of the amendments, you'll see in Section 6, we put into operation July 1st, Section 2 of the amendment, which allows for a phase-in of the time so the Department of Forestry can do this rulemaking over a year-long process so we don't generate a fiscal by them having to do it right away. So this list will stay in statute for a year. The list then disappears and gets replaced by this general statement of what special forest products are. Mr. Chair, I have with me Mr. Jim James, the Executive Director of OSWA, and Chris Germer from OFIC. We have some other witnesses who have experienced this firsthand. We'd love to have them have a chance to talk about it, and I'd be happy to answer questions. Thank
Perfect.
You.
Thank you very much. Who's next?
Okay. Chairman Witt and members of the Agricultural Natural Resource Committee, my name is Jim James. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. OSWA is an organization that represents the interest of family forests in Oregon. We have over 250,000 acres of family forest land represented by our members. A truffle is an edible fungus that grows in the forest, typically around Douglas fir roots. It's a very valuable fungus, and it's also has been identified as a delicacy in the marketplace. There is a good market today for truffles in Oregon. They can be very valuable. Small woodland owners are very dependent on secondary products for their income. They don't have large acreage to have harvests of timber every year. And having truffles eligible for theft because of they're not identified as secondary products is a problem for landowners. This bill will correct that problem and give them the legal justification they have to protect their property. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members, Chris Jarmer, Oregon Forest Industries Council. Appreciate you hearing this bill. Appreciate all the good work that Roger and Jim have done on this. We're totally in support of the bill. Appreciate the time. Would take any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Clem.
So this might already be current law, but how does it work if somebody's out hunting and they see a chanterelle mushroom? And it's on some timber company's land that opened the gate.
And private land. Mr. Chair, I believe under current law, your person is allowed to gather up to 1 gallon of mushrooms without having a permit.
Okay. I may need to go make a phone call here in a minute.
Buddy.
All right.
1 gallon
per year.
That is actually the
okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lamb, the statute speaks to transporting of special forest products. Mm-hmm. So we have an expert beside us, but the law says they can transport up to 1 gallon of mushrooms. So it's not per person, it's per vehicle that's doing the transporting.
Per day, or?
I believe it'd probably be per day, but I don't know about that for a fact.
Good morning, sir. I suspect you may have some clarifications for us. Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Yeah, I'm Deputy Davey with the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office. So employed with them for 15 years. In the last 5 years, I've been assigned to Forest Patrol. Mm-hmm. But to answer your question, Representative Clem, actually, you can't remove any forest product or any type of product from anybody's property without a permit, otherwise it'd be theft. But the special forest product falls under where state lands and, or public lands where they issue permits for like rhododendrons, bare grass, commercial type use forest products. The government issues permits for those, and you can remove them with a permit. But as far as chanterelle mushrooms or other mushrooms, you can remove them from public lands, but you have to follow their guidelines as well. So there's a balance there. That's where the confusion lies, where people think they can have up to a gallon of mushrooms. Mm-hmm. But if you trespass on someone's private land, that's a totally different thing. That would be theft. Mm-hmm. If you were to harvest without a permit.
Okay. I'll just take that into account. I don't like mushrooms or eat them, but I know some people who maybe pick a few here and there. I just got to talk to them a little bit about this.
Correct. I kind of get this whole thing generated after about 3 years ago, is when I first came across truffle hunters.
Yeah.
And there's a loophole. Like, everybody seems to think a truffle is a mushroom. Well, it's subterranean, and it attaches itself to the root system of the tree, which then again provides nutrients and to the tree as well as part of the environmental chain where moles and mice and squirrels feed on them, and then you have the owls that feed on them. So it interrupts the chain of events there out there in the forest. So I'm kind of getting lost. I'm a little nervous here, but
oh, I got it. Yeah.
But truffles is excluded. People seem to think truffles is a mushroom, which it's not. So a lot of people will say, well, it's a mushroom, and I can have up to a gallon. If you were to have a gallon of chanterelle mushrooms, we're talking thousands of dollars. I mean, truffles. You have white truffles, you have Oregon black truffle, and brown truffles. But if you were to have a gallon of truffles, we're talking pounds, and they run on the market for $20 an ounce, depending upon the truffle.
Wow. Maybe just one more question.
Please. Sorry.
So if the gates unlock, so you have permission to be there, but you don't have a sign either way about the mushrooms because they're off in the middle of nowhere, there's no way to sign them. The assumption is you can't pick them unless you've been given explicit authority to pick them.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Not for the picking. So, okay. Representative Whitsitt.
Yes, I was wondering if you could describe what sort of rocks or minerals are identified as special forest products. Is this like if you're picking up gravel to take home and put in your driveway, large amounts, or is it? Could you describe what that means?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, under current statute, rocks and minerals are not part of special forest products. Right. We would ask that they be added as the generic definition so that the first thing that would come to mind would be a flagstaff out of rock pits, for instance. Many forest landowners have rock pits on their property, and they can sell the rocks out of the rock pit for landscape purposes. So that's what instantly comes to mind, landscape rocks. Well, again, that would be defined by a Board of Forestry rule. The generic would be that any and all rocks and minerals are private property when they're on private forest land, and that they would all be subject to theft if they are taken.
Okay. I'd just like to say, one is organic and everything else, inorganic, and then everything else is organic in the list, so it's kind of an odd thing. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but forest product, it's an earth product. It would be more like mining or something like that if you're actually going to take a lot of it out of the ground to landscape. So just trying to establish what you mean. So you would say it's illegal to pick up a rock if you're walking out through the forest?
Well, I guess Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, yes, any and all would be considered at that point in time a special forest product, but it'd be, once the Board of Forestry, I would assume what we're talking about here is landscape rocks.
Okay. Vice Chair McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Good morning. Thank you for being here. This is fascinating for me. I live in mushroom country. So I'm just trying to parlay this into what's already happening on forest lands down in my area. People purchase a permit if they're a commercial harvester. They have areas where they can go and pick. They bring it in to a central location, and they sell it to the mushroom processor, and they get it into the open market. So what this does is just add truffles to that same plethora of things that they can go out and harvest under the rules that already exist.
Correct. I just like to have truffles included, because there's a confusion on what a truffle is as far as a mushroom.
So really, you're not changing any of the rules for people who are either recreational and go out and pick a few to go home and cook for dinner under the rules that already exist.
Correct.
Or the commercial picker who has a license to go out under the regulations that are already in place. All you're doing is adding truffles to the lobsters and the cauliflowers and the chanterelles and everything else that they're already picking.
Yeah, that was my intention, to add truffles, as well as not being able to dig or rape without a permit, because I have handouts here where there's a lot of devastation caused to the ground and the root system of trees when people go out there and harvest truffles, people that are inexperienced. And that's part of the problem as well, as far as the damage caused to the tree farms.
Please.
So there is a difference in truffle harvesting as opposed to the others, which are just taken at the surface?
Correct.
Okay.
So there is subterranean.
There is a difference. So is there then, follow up,
please.
Is there then some sort of a procedure you want to put into place that would train a commercial harvester so that they're doing the least amount of damage? Or how are you getting to the point where you're eliminating that potential damage that you're talking about?
I don't have an answer for that. There's groups within the state that are clubs, and actually I've run into them before where they'll go on a field trip and then trespass on someone's property without permission, and they're going out there teaching people how to harvest truffles with a fee, of course. They'll charge people for these field trips.
Follow up?
Yes.
But that trespass is different.
Correct.
Than what I'm thinking you're getting at was just adding you can harvest truffles also. They're defined differently, and you're putting under the category of mushroom hunting.
Correct. That's what people seem to think they're mushroom hunting when they're actually, it's totally different. Like you said, they're subterranean, so there's a different procedure in collecting them.
So, follow up one more time.
Mr. McKeown, please feel free to
Sorry.
Your line of questions.
That's fine, Mr. Beyer. So, if you're representing a small woodland owner, or, sir, if you want to weigh in too, you have a trespass issue, but then you have a damage issue. So are we looking at two different things here? I'm a little confused by this impacts your organization.
My perception is what this would require is a permit to transport those truffles, and the landowner would have to give you the permit. Therefore, the landowner would have an opportunity to put restrictions on what you do with that permit to collect the truffles. So I perceive that's how that issue would be handled now.
Mr. Chair and members of Representative McKeown, recognize this statute doesn't deal with the harvesting of any of these special forest products. It's the transportation of the special forest product that is regulated. The harvesting and the practices to harvest would be regulated by the landowners, not subject to legislation. This is strictly the transportation of those products, and that's where the violation would be if someone transports a special forest product illegally. We're replacing the word mushroom with fungi, so that would incorporate the truffle but it's the transportation of, not the harvesting of.
Okay. So one more. So what I'm trying to understand is all you're trying to do is add fungi to the list of transportable products. Okay.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Sorry for the confusion.
That's okay.
Any additional questions or comments? Gentlemen, that was excellent testimony and also very interesting. And Deputy Davey, I want to thank you very much for helping to clarify a number of the questions that our committee had. It's much appreciated.
You're welcome. Thank you for hearing me.
Absolutely. And with that, I'm going to call forward Jim Dennison, and while he's on his way up, is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify today on House Bill 2615? Show of hands. Not seeing any. Sir, welcome.
Thank you, Representative Witt and members of the committee. I've prepared a written statement which you think received, and I don't think I'm going to try to read it. We probably, as
Mr.
my wife
Dennison?
And I, are probably the first or second
Mr. Dennison?
Tree farmers to be
sir Ma'am, please, excuse my interruption. Would you please formally introduce yourself for the record?
My name is Jim Dennison.
Good morning, sir. Welcome.
I'm a retired professional forester and a land surveyor, and I've managed lands in Lincoln County for over 60 years.
Well, thank you.
For various companies. My wife and I were notified by the deputy sheriff that we'd had a trespass on our lands, not knowing most of the time, thinking of it probably with some trees cut or some firewood taken or something. We weren't sure what it was. After seeing the damage that's been done to the soil for where a criminal is harvesting truffles, there's a lot of root damage. My concern as a professional forester is that there's diseased insects can enter the root system of a 40-year-old stand that this occurred in, and we could be losing trees then. I think that I'll say that I think the special forest products need to be listed, and it's hard to list all of the products that could come out of a forest. But I think that this bill will do the job, and I want to commend the sheriff's departments for the work that they did to provide us information. If any questions, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dennison. Do we have questions for our guests this morning? Not seeing any, sir. Thank you very, very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
And last and final call for House Bill 2615. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2615. And have we had an opportunity to get in contact with Rep. Jensen just yet?
This one's on right now, but you could finish this.
Okay. While we're waiting for Representative Jensen, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3408. Beth?
No.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3408 is the bill that Rep. Kenny Geyer was just discussing. It would delete the statutory preference for placing a forfeited animal with a person having prior contact with that animal. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to call up, please, Sharon Harmon. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Sharon Harmon. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Humane Society. We are a private nonprofit in the state serving the animals of this community, unaffiliated with any other national or local organization. Thank you today. I'll be brief. I know you have a lot on your agenda. House Bill 3408 is a bill we support because the current law ties our hands with respect to placement of forfeited animals, in that we're required to give preference to family members of the person who had originally been cruel to the animal. What we would like to do is have that family preference removed with the understanding that none of us want to see animals separated from good homes. There certainly are circumstances where, in the case of domestic violence, where the animals have been abused to get control of the spouse. In those circumstances, of course, it makes all the sense in the world to place the pet with the person who has been abused. But often family members are in the same house. They've been watching the abuse. We haven't enough evidence to charge them with it, but it doesn't make any sense at all for us to put that pet back into a situation where either people have been ignoring, have been participating. We would just like to do the good job we do in finding good homes for pets. So we appreciate the latitude that 3408 and removing a direction towards family preference in the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
questions or comments for Ms. Harmon?
Okay, better.
Okay, Vice Chair Esquivel, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you not have the ability, if I were in a family and I lived in a house and I abused an animal, don't you have the ability to just say no to that situation? I mean, that astounds me.
The law says
that would be like placing a child into danger, even though it's a family member.
Representative Witt, Representative Esquivel, and that is exactly the circumstance that we find ourselves in when we have acquired animals through the forfeiture process. The law says family preference, it must be given. So
it doesn't say you have to place it. It says preference.
Exactly. So in order for Representative Esquivel, Mr. Chairman, we would have to, you know, prove to some extent that this was an unsuitable home by virtue of either a criminal action. You know, we don't feel as placement agencies that the law gives us the latitude to do what's right for the pet. We're very mindful. We always want to play by the rules. And by removing this criteria from the statutes, we feel like we're able to do that job. Right now, we don't feel like we can.
Representative Klim.
Thank you. Can you, Sharon, remind me what we did either last session or the session before that was about the actual home? We did something to say it won't go back to this same home already, not dealing with people in the home, but or the same location or something, because we had people who were people. So someone would do the abuse, and then it ended up going back to the same place because somebody said, no, that's my dog, not his dog. Or maybe it was about ownership. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Klim, there have been a number of tweaks to the forfeiture provision, and this is pre-sentencing forfeiture. So before the case is adjudicated and before a judge can say, you are prohibited under Oregon law from owning a pet for either 5 years under the misdemeanor statutes or 15 years under the felony level crimes from owning a pet, they can still be in the same house. They can still have contact with each other. So it's an yes, and I would like to say the dog offers this testimony as well, that it's a minor issue that doesn't come up very often, but when it does, our hands are tied.
I could try again.
Please.
What is it we did before? Was that post-forfeiture we said you... I'm just trying to remember what we did before. We did something recently that was about people who said, no, that's not my dog. Or someone asserted ownership to a dog when the person who abused it was a way to keep it in the same home, and we made a change to say you can't do that. You know,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Klim, I couldn't recall, and I wouldn't want to speak to it in error.
So,
yes, Representative.
Yeah, thank you. So I like what we're trying to do here. I am a little nervous about what we're doing. Isn't just deleting family members in this bill, though. We're deleting the preference for anyone who had prior contact, no matter who it is. And I'm nervous about the, you know, if we're talking not the same home, so I go crazy one day and do something terrible to my dog, and my dog loves my dad who lives 2 hours away, and in this case it'd be a family member as well. If he were involved in watching what I did and let it go, I have no problem saying he should never get access. But if he didn't, I sort of like the idea that if there's a relationship there already with a person, even if it's not a family, with a person, I sort of like the idea that that's where the dog would go instead of just, you know, lost in the world and hopefully likes its new family versus loves its, you know, my dad would call it, it's his grandpup. And so that's the only thing I'm nervous about is there something in between not having any reference at all to a person with a connection, which is what would happen if we do this amendment. This isn't limited to just family members.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Klim, I share your sentiment. I mean, we want these animals that have had a terrible turn of life to have the best life. And that may be with someone that's in the family that has had contact. It may be somebody you pet-sitted. It may be the cousin. It may be the estranged spouse. There's nothing that says we aren't going to do the right thing. We just want to be careful that the law doesn't make us do the wrong thing. And, you know, when it comes to neglected animals, these are already hard ones to place. You know, the perception is these are damaged goods, and sometimes, frankly, they are. So we're going to make an effort to find the best home. We all want to find a home as quickly and the right home as soon as possible. This law just points us in a direction that sometimes isn't the right way to go. I just want to make sure that we all have the opportunity to do the right thing.
Yes. So what would happen if we pass this is a judge would hopefully factor in those kind of connections, but there would be no preference that they had to go with. It's just they would hopefully ask, is there somebody who loves this dog who's not the jerk who beats it that, you know, here in the courtroom or something? So they could still, the judge could still give a connection-based mm-hmm. preference if they choose to. There just would be no statutory preference for a past connection.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Glenn, that would certainly be my hope, and that is our practice today at our shelter when we deal with animals. Yeah. And the most common circumstances in the case of domestic violence or in child abuse, where the animal has been used as a tool to control the victim. The animal has been the victim in horrific ways, and we're going to look to make the right placement for it. It just may not be in that same house. It may not be a relative, or it may be that same family.
Yeah, just one last comment. I'm not worried about you. I'm worried about all the places you don't operate in Oregon where there's just a judge. That's what I'm thinking about. But, you know, I do like the way we're going here. I'm just trying to think about something else. It doesn't have to be done here because we're running out of time.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Clem, I share your sentiment, and you know, the courts in Oregon tend to do a good job with animal cases when they have the resources to get to them.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Representative Krieger?
Kind of strange in that we're doing this with dogs. We just passed legislation, which several of us voted on. It gives preference to family members for children that are taken into dependency, and they're taken out of the family members to give them to another family member if they're capable. And the judge looks at that, and as this existing statute says, whom the agency determines are capable of providing necessary, adequate, and appropriate levels of care. In other words, what is in the best interest of the child? What is the best interest of the dog? I think we've already got it covered.
I do too. Okay. Additional questions or comments? Representative Whitson.
We had a case down in Klamath County where someone had to go out of state, and they left a herd of cattle with their daughter-in-law to feed, and she was from a city, and she'd come in to take care of them. She did not know how much to feed them. This herd went down and down and down. Finally, my husband and I stopped to see what was going on, but someone else could have turned her in. They could have confiscated the herd of cattle. She had no idea how much she was supposed to feed them. Once we told her, she was fine with it, but what would happen if she'd been turned in, that herd was confiscated of cattle because she didn't know what she was doing? Then would they not get this herd? And we're talking about a lot of money. And so I'm concerned about the animals being used as commodities in a business. You have the potential to ruin somebody by somebody else not understanding what they were supposed to do. And she was great once we stopped by and said, you have to feed them more than you're feeding them. And so I would be very concerned about the way this is written. Somebody could lose all their cattle or, you know, something else really valuable for lack of knowledge of a family member.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Whitsitt, thank you for intervening and providing that education. We hope that's what happens in all communities. Livestock are an especially complex issue with regards to ownership and custody and liens, and no law enforcement wants to take on a herd of cows. That's for sure.
All right. With that, just by a show of hands, I need to know if there's anyone else who wants to testify on this bill before I close the public hearing. Not seeing anyone, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3408. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3452. And while Representative Jensen comes forward, I'm going to ask Beth to tell us a little bit about the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3452 describes the circumstances under which a gray wolf may be taken. There are no amendments in your packet to this bill at this point, no revenue impact on the original bill. We do not yet have a fiscal impact statement.
Good morning, Representative Jensen.
Good morning, Chair Witt. For the record, my name is Bob Jensen, State Representative from House District 58.
Welcome.
And thank you, for hearing House Bill 3452. House Bill 3452 is currently a little bit of a work in progress. It's a bill that has been kind of around the building a little bit before this particular session. So some of you at least have had the opportunity to look at it before, and some of you I recognize probably have had other things to do in your life than sit around and read legislation that you were not in any way going to be able to respond to. But it's it is, I guess, would be referred to kind of as the wolf bill, if you please. This bill has had a substantial amount of energy and work that's gone into it, even though the writing is much the same as it was 2 years ago. But the proposal, that we have is that it pass out of the committee and the House, and we've had extended conversations with the Senate committee that would likely, or the chair of the Senate committee that would likely hear this, and have talked about amendments that are perhaps necessary. And before the bill goes, to the House, at least in the House floor speech, it would be the intention to pretty well outline those amendments. I could talk at your pleasure about what some of those are, but we'd understand that the language that LC has is not yet adopted or has not yet been given to us. So. At any rate, the issue has to do with what to do about predation. The Oregon stock growers, cattle is kind of in the limelight in the area that the wolves are most frequently found. Although other stock growers are also affected, sheep farmers, ranchers in my county, Umatilla County, have encountered significant problems with predation as far as the wolf is concerned. So, they seem to have some wolves seem to have an affinity for good marble beef, and some seem to have an affinity for other, perhaps easier to come by, dinners. So the ranchers and farmers of Oregon recognize and appreciate that wolves are part of the natural environment here, and they're committed to recovery of the species. However, the wolf plan, which was adopted before many of us were in the legislature, I think Representative Krieger probably was here at the adoption of the wolf plan. The wolf plan, recognizes that it's a plan by ODF&W to manage the animal in such a way that they will become part of a natural environment, you know, that we have here, but in such a way as part of that natural environment that they won't completely disrupt, you know, other things in the environment. I could go on at, you know, some great length, but there are some other people that are here that would be prepared to talk to you about some of the issues, some of the problems, some of the concerns that we have or had. And let me just kind of leave my comments with that and suggest that I'd be delighted that at any questions you might have, I would try to answer them. And if I couldn't answer them, I could probably identify some people that would be able to answer them.
Thank you very, very much, Representative Jensen. Appreciate your comments and the bill very much. So just to be absolutely clear, my understanding is that you have told us that there are some amendments that are necessary to this bill before we send it over to the Senate.
That is my my opinion on it. Yes, and those amendments are to provide some protections, especially clear up some possible misunderstandings that people might have about the intent that some of the folks have.
Senator Hansel, welcome to our committee. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. Ran from a teleconference here, and it's great to be here. I certainly support the bill, I wanted to testify that we have just returned from a weekend in the Nogales.
Senator, would you please remind us who you are?
Yes.
Thank you.
I'm not used to being on this side. Senator Bill Hansel, District 29. Representative Jensen and Senator Dingfelder and I just spent a weekend in the Wallowas looking at this issue, and we are very optimistic that sides can come together and that we can have a meaningful bill that will help forward management. District 29 pretty much has all the wolf packs in Oregon within the framework of that and in Representative Jensen's district. It's a huge issue for livestock growers and the economy of this part of the state. Wolves are now a part of the landscape, and management is the key. Other states have effective wolf management plans and practices. And this bill, this House bill provides, we feel, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and the growers and others the tools needed to help manage wolves. I also realize that there'll be some amendments that'll need to be made to it, but it's good public policy, and we would urge your considerations in passing this bill.
Thank you very, very much. Questions or comments for either or both of our colleagues? Representative Krieger.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I don't know if we have time to get amendments in and get your revenue impacts. You may want to move the bill as it is and have it fixed in the Senate.
Thank you for that consideration. I appreciate everyone's attentiveness to the timeline. Additional questions or comments? I'm not seeing any. Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Appreciate your testimony, and we will be very much attuned to Representative Krieger's notation of where we are on our schedule here for this for the next couple of days. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Representative Jensen.
We appreciate your consideration and the thoughtfulness that the committee will go through as you grapple with this issue and with the subject matter involved. So we appreciate your work and look forward to being able to help you in any way we can.
Representative Clem?
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Former Co-Chair. So when we were doing that work in whatever that was, early 2011, we had a bill, but I don't think this is it. And I'm wondering if that bill is also somewhere else in the legislature right now. And we passed it, and it passed across the House floor with 50-plus votes. It had to do with completing the final part of the Wolf Management Plan. But I don't think that's this bill, or is it, and I'm not remembering correctly.
No, Mr. Chair and Representative Clem, your memory is not failing you, as perhaps mine might do to me once in a while. That bill currently is not in this bill that you have. It's a bill, I think, that was initially introduced, if I'm recalling correctly, by Representative Bentz. That bill is one of the issues that we want to discuss with all of the stakeholders as one of the possible amendments that I was alluding to.
Yeah, okay.
So it was a good bill, I think, and addressed some of the very basic sort of needs. But I did not want to add that bill to this without having all of the people that may be affected or involved at the table before we brought it to committee.
Well, considering 50 of us voted for it and it didn't get a hearing in the Senate, maybe we do got to try talking a little more first. This didn't work out so well.
Yeah, okay.
We have our emissary with us this morning, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent. Very, very appreciative, Senator Hansel. And just to be, again, to be very clear, Representative Jensen, the amendments that you have in mind are in process now. They're being drafted.
They're not at LC. We will be getting them to LC today.
Okay, very good, sir. Anything more from either of you gentlemen? All right, with that, I want to thank you very, very much for your testimony. Appreciate it.
Okay.
And have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to call up, please, Robert Clavens and McKenna Fisher, please. And before they start, committee members, just a reminder that in order for us to be able to clear our calendar before we start on Senate bills and for us to get all of our agenda over to the Senate, you received a notice, and we more than likely may have to be having a short session this evening. And I just wanted to remind you of that so that you can be thinking about that for the next few minutes. With that, Beth, if you'd please, we're good. welcome to our committee. Good morning.
Thank you. Excuse me, Representative Witt, or Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rob Clavens. I'm the wildlife advocate for Oregon Wild. For a number of reasons, including that I'm losing my voice, I'll keep it very, very short. And suffice it to say, as the bill is currently written, Oregon Wild has to strongly oppose the bill. It goes far beyond what the Wolf Plan contemplated, could allow poaching to go unpunished. And bottom line, we'd prefer to focus on preventing conflict and getting back to the Wolf Plan we thought we had in 2005. I've submitted some written testimony on behalf of several organizations that are currently working on a settlement that would get us back there. I hope you'll take an opportunity to look at that. And I will actually leave it there, which is maybe the most concise I've ever been in this table.
Thank you very much for being so concise. Appreciate that. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. My name is McKenna Grace Fisher. I've never done anything like this before, and I basically am an animal rights activist in my own free time. I spend many hours advocating for every kind of animal you can imagine, including house pets. My concern, being a layperson in understanding, I don't even know what the amendments are. All I know is that in our history in Oregon, Washington, California, and even the Rockies, we've had severe issues with complete dissemination of wolves where they've gone down to zero. My concern is that to accommodate ranchers, cattle raising people, that we constantly are killing off our wildlife to accommodate them so they can have their animals, you know, graze on grass and not have to fear that their livestock is going to be taken by wild animals. I want to make sure that there's a strong understanding and awareness that we have to take into consideration that wildlife is part of nature and it's part of what makes our earth and Oregon especially the great place that it is. We have to make sure that we do not go back to what happened in the late 1800s and 1900s where we wiped out everything. And if you think about it, back then there weren't the cattle ranchers that we have today. So for us to actually exterminate the wolf in that period of time, back in the late 1800s, it's very, very concerning that we could possibly, as this gentleman, I'm sorry, I forgot your name, mentioned, that we will end up with poachers, which we already have an issue with as it is. So the oversight that we have to have, these amendments, which I'm not familiar with, we just have to make sure that the bill strongly emphasizes protection of our wolves and that we're not just handing out permits like they're doing in Idaho where there's wolf hunts constantly. I mean, all across the United States, we have a free-range ability to kill as many wolves as you want. That cannot happen here. We have to maintain integrity and a morality around what our wildlife means to us and to accommodate livestock, and I hate calling them that because they're animals to me. I just find it very concerning that we're going to lose control. And, you know, hunters are 6% of the population. And once they find out they can get a wolf tag, all bets are off. And we've seen this happen all across the United States. All you have to do is Google and you can find out all the stories. And this includes bear hunting as well. So, anyway, I have a lot of notes here, but I think I just kind of went off the cuff, and I really appreciate everyone's attention and time. And just seriously think about what our wildlife means to us in Oregon. I've lived here since 1974, raised in San Diego, and, you know, this state means a lot to me. And I don't want to see our wolves, exterminated because we need to accommodate ranchers. There's got to be some kind of middle ground that we can meet on. And, you know, rules in place that protect them. I guess that's all I have to say. I appreciate your time.
Thank you,
Representative Witt. I'm sorry, I'm probably not being politically
correct.
You're
doing wonderful.
Thank
in fact, Ms. Fisher, you said that you're not accustomed to testifying, and you seem like you're a pro. So,
well,
great job.
I do a lot of stuff online, so I appreciate your time very much.
Right.
So.
We appreciate your testimony. Are there any questions or comments for this panel? I'm not seeing any. Thank you very, very much. Appreciate that. Next, I'm going to call up, please, Rod Childers and Bill Hoyt. And while they're coming up, is there anyone else in the audience that's going to want to testify on this bill today?
John Williams.
Okay, why doesn't he come up? Oh, there he is. Okay. Sorry, sir, I skipped you on the list here.
I think John needs that computer.
Okay. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome to each of you. We have we probably have about 15 minutes here, so if you could kind of pace yourselves accordingly, I would appreciate it very, very much. Welcome to our committee.
Okay. Thank you, and thank you for holding this hearing. My name's Rod Childers. I'm the Oregon Cattlemen's Wolf Committee Chairman. I'm from Wallowa County, and I would like to begin with that I've been the Wolf Committee Chair for over 5 years now, and I've worked with ranchers and with this legislative body in trying to move legislation forward that we believe that was a necessity to be able to manage wolves in this state reasonably with for us as well as the agency and other Oregonians and things. I'm proud to say that even though our patience is running thin out there, we've had depredations for over 3 years now and things that none of us have taken a wolf, and there hasn't been any illegal taking of a wolf by producers and things in this state. And that we, as LCA, we publicly oppose the wolf plan, and ranchers are abiding by it, and we are implementing the non-lethal measures that the agency has recommended, that being ODF and W. We simply want to keep our livestock alive and out of harm's way, and we need all the tools to be available for varying circumstances. I am here to request that you pass House Bill 3452 to uphold the intentions of the WOOF plan and the wildlife damage statutes, which provide authority for producers to protect livestock from predators and wildlife causing damage. This is simply the right thing to do from a standpoint of the humane treatment of animals, and upholding our private property rights and supporting our family businesses and our rural communities. Things. Ranchers, we spend a lot of time out there trying to keep our livestock alive and helping maintain the infrastructure of our communities and things in Eastern Oregon. And we believe that we need this bill to help move that, get to maintain that. OCA has always maintained the COD in the Act definition in the WOOF plan has been meaningless for ranchers because of the requirement for the WOOF to actually be caught in the Act, which means we got to catch them biting things. First, we have to have chronic depredation and by according to the WOOF plan. And then if we get to that and the agency decides that they want to give us permits, what they call Caught in the Act permits, which there's been over the last 3 years, there's been over 70 of those permits issued in Willow County on just one pack of the six packs of wolves that we have now in Eastern Oregon. And things, out of all of those permits that have been issued, nobody has ever caught a wolf in the act of actually biting. And that's what this permit goes beyond. This permitless take would go beyond that and allow in harassment or in the presence of our livestock, we'd be able to do it. But that, and we look at that as, you know, something that we're working on these amendments, and we agree with that we do need to sit down and have some more discussion and things to make sure we try to respond to all of the concerns. Thanks. This is the Department of the ODF and W officials have also recognized that expanding the take language has not greatly increased wolf deaths in other states. Even in states where laws basically shoot on sight, livestock producers taking wolves remain a small percentage of the overall death, the lethal take of wolves. And in fact, up till through 2010, less than half of 1% of all wolves taken in the Northwest had been by producers with that Caught in the Act language as it's written today. So, I mean, you're not going to exterminate wolves by this. You may hear surveys indicating there's public support for wolf recovery, and however, it is rarely noted that while 70% of respondents to a Defenders of Wildlife survey said wolves should be recovered to some level, 90% of them also said ranchers should not bear the brunt of costs for the wolf recovery. And minimizing the seriousness of this issue by talking about percentage of all cattle losses or numbers of all cattle in the state compared to the number of wolves. now colonized in one region of our state, does not accurately characterize the irreparable damage wolves are causing to several of our families over there. And that cannot, and they cannot sustain these types of losses and things as you go. We have the depredations, but we also have a large amount of missing livestock that occurs out there. You end up, a lot of the studies will show that we only find about one out of every six that are confirmed and things. So, and I know Mr. Williams has got a PowerPoint here that we'd like to get to, so I'd like to put the rest of my time to John.
Okay. About how long is that PowerPoint going to take?
About 7 minutes.
That'll just about take up all of your time. Is that will that work for you?
We'll I'll shorten it down as much as I can.
Yeah. Okay. Very good, sir. Thank you.
So I'm John Williams. I'm Oregon State University Associate Professor in the Department of Rangeland Resources. And I'm working in Willamette County as the OSU Extension agent up there. I've been working with a group of researchers, as you see on the wolf-cattle interaction research. The issue is that we find dead cows, we find live cows. This was a cow that was actually found that was alive, had to be euthanized. This was a cow that was killed about 2 weeks before calving season. Our study design is basically three ranches or four ranches over in Idaho where there's lots of wolves, and three to four ranches, we've gone to four ranches in the last 2 years in Oregon where there was beginning no wolves, and now we have low density of wolves, but none of the research facilities or ranches have had wolves at the present time. We're monitoring cattle movement, site preference, wolf movement, site preference, wolf activity, and wolf-cattle interactions. To do that, we're working on these collars that we put on cattle and similar collars that we put on wolves. This is a type of data that we get off of our cows. Every 5 minutes, that collar goes off, goes up to the satellite, finds out where the cow is, puts it on an SD card, and shuts down, waits 5 minutes, and does it again for up to 9 months. Wolf depredations are also included in the research to find out where those depredations are occurring. This is on one of the research ranches. In fact, the one wolf that we've had very good data off of was actually captured in this area where all those depredations are occurring, and that's the rancher's calving pasture. This is the type of data we get off of the wolf. We have the wolf with a collar that's going off once every 15 minutes. We weren't sure we were going to get the collar back near as quickly as we know we're going to get the collars back in the fall. The average daily distance, this is the type of information we're getting from this research, 11.4 miles a day on average, as high as 27 to 30 miles. 27 on our information, ODF&W has one that went 30 miles actually in 6 hours. 210 square miles is the site size of the area that this wolf had when he had his collar on. About 3.1% of those were within of the time of these dots were within 500 meters of a house. So the discussion of, so do I bring my livestock in close to the house? Does that protect them? We didn't find that to be the case with the data that we've received. We saw a maximum movement of over 6 miles in 1 hour. In 2 hours, it was over 8 miles. We had 10 collars on each ranch that were put on cows. We were in hopes that those collars would interact with the wolf that had the collar on it every now and then. We put 500 meters since there's a 5 minute and a 15 minute interval. And so we looked at that at 500 meters, that'd be an interaction. It was actually 783 times. We moved that down to 100 meters, which is a football field in an end zone. We had 53 times. 52 of those were at night. So when you start looking at non-lethal issues and you start looking at being able to shoot them or to find them, the reality is we didn't find action occurring very often, particularly when they were getting into the cattle. It wasn't happening during the daytime. This is a graph on showing how far you are from the house versus how many dots there are on the map. Simply a pretty much a straight line indicating that we're not seeing an effect from occupied houses in our study area. We're also looking at distribution of livestock. If you look at the lower right-hand corner of that in 2008, there's no dots down there. And there was moderate wolf densities. In 2009, there was actually 28 wolves that were on that site. And the wolves moved back down into the corner where they were trying to go home. It was downhill. 2009, after they took 15 of those wolves out, they were not back down in that area. 2010, the wolf population was back up, and we see them moving back down. It's the type of data that we're getting, preliminary. Another data that shows how far do they move on an hourly basis. As soon as it gets night, they move up. As it turns daylight, they tend to settle down and not move near as much. So what have we learned? Wolves can frequently interact with livestock, mostly at night. Wolves alter livestock behavior, both spatially and temporally. Wolves change in their temperament. Wolves increase the cost of livestock, rearing, particularly on extensive rangelands. There's no easy fixes. With different ranching styles, you can have different protection, such as being in close where you could put flattery up versus out on the range you cannot. And we're looking at it saying the more solid data we have, the more rational decisions we can make. This is the type of cooperation that we've had. So with that, do you want me to, I have a 2-minute video of what we have found.
Sir, we're out of time.
What we're finding.
Email that to us?
Dr. Williams, thank you very, very much. Appreciate your
put it on OLIS.
Yeah, we can put that on OLIS if you'd like to share that with us.
What's that?
We can put that on our internal access.
Okay.
If you would like to share that with the committee, happy to do that.
That'd be great.
Thank you very much, sir. I appreciate it. Good morning, Bill. I've got 3 minutes at the max for you.
I won't take that long, Chair Witt. Chair Witt, member of the committee, my name is Bill Hoyt. I am the immediate past president of the Oregon Cattlemen Association legislative chair. And I've been in part of the negotiations for all of the wolf bills that have been successful in passage through this body in the last 2 years. And I've been part of the negotiation for the, as far as the wolf is concerned, in all the bills that have been come before you over the last 10 years. And I think this is a very reasonable bill. I think we want to keep all as many tools in the box as we possibly can. The Oregon Cattlemen Association very much supports this bill and hopes that you pass it on to the Senate. And with that, I appreciate the fact we have the opportunity to be here, and I'm sure that there'll be more discussion down the road.
Thank you very, very much for that succinct testimony. Appreciate all three of you committee members. Do we have anything for this panel? I just have one very short question. We have had testimony that this bill could allow poaching. That's a very dirty word in my vocabulary. In your estimation, is there any one of the three of you that think in the slightest manner this bill could allow or encourage poaching?
I don't believe it does. And I've been involved in this thing for years, and I just don't see where that's coming from, to be honest with you.
Chair Witt, this bill directly relates to producers who interact with wolves in their pastures, and I see no direct correlation to the fact that it could be extrapolated to mean that it would allow poachers.
Thank you. Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, Mr. Chair, I've never seen a poacher adhere to the law in the first place.
And with that, anything further? Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Appreciate your testimony and the fact that you've come a considerable distance to be here today.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to call up Justin Martin, and as he's coming forward, is there anyone else today who would like to testify on House Bill 3452? Hands. Not seeing any. Justin, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin. I am here today on behalf of Defenders of Wildlife. I will be very, very brief. We are here in opposition to House Bill 3452 as written. I have talked with Mr. Elliker and other folks. So that being said, I would like to say that, you know, 8 years ago I was locked in a conference room, fortunately with a cooler of beer and a lot of folks that are here with me today, and we were able to sit down and work on compromise language, both with the management plan and language. I was also very proud to be a part in 2011 with this legislature passing a bill that allowed for compensation to livestock owners when the Defenders of Wildlife Trust was coming to an end. It's always nice to see your photo in the Capitol Press alongside Bill Hoyt, Representative Smith, Katie Fast, and Jim Walsh. So that being said, while we do not support this bill in the current form, we do know that it's going to be worked in a compromised fashion after it leaves this committee, and we will be at that table, and as always, we will be willing to work with all the stakeholders. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for this opportunity, and we look forward to that process.
Justin, thank you. Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for your expressed willingness to work on this bill. It's greatly appreciated. Questions or comments for Mr. Martin? I'm not seeing any. Thank you very much. Again, last and final call for House Bill 3452. Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3452. Anything for the good of the order?
What time are we meeting tonight?
6 o'clock tonight.
My computer's completely locked up.
Okay. Folks, just for those of you who may have showed up for House Bill 2745, we are going to...
I'm a computer guy. Remember, it's my business.
Yeah. We're going to hear that briefly this evening at 6 o'clock. And committee members, we're going to recess here until 6 o'clock. If any of you can't make it, and I understand it's a great imposition, please let me know. Anything further for the good of the order? With that, the committee will be in recess until 6 p.m. this